Good morning, everybody. Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see people. This is my first shir of the day in this extravaganza for Mizrahi, and very much looking forward to it. I'm so excited. People are coming to all of the different classes here and in Hendon, etc. I just wanted to read out that the shir right now is given Le'ilu Nishmas Yefet Chai Ben Sa'id Salah Halevi, and there should be an aliyah for the neshama Be'ezrat Hashem, an appreciation for their sponsorship. So we have a class right now, a shir on who made the rabbis boss Torah thoughts on rabbinic law. And honestly, in 40 minutes, what we're almost just going to do is just flag certain topics and say, okay, now you need to go off and hear a shir on that, and a shir on that, and a shir on this, and a shir on that. This is an area that I do very much, I enjoy and I'm interested in, and there are a lot of sources about this topic, the development of halacha and how that works. I'm giving a shir later in the day in there on the Shulchan Aruch and the development of the Shulchan Aruch and the controversial aspects of the Shulchan Aruch. But there are tons of sources on this, and we don't give them over enough. Certainly not in schools, where we somehow expect kids to just accept that what is rabbinic law and why it's binding, and we never really explain it and never really get into the structure of it. So if you're interested in going into this more, I'm happy to give you some recommendations. I have some on my website. You see at the bottom here it says to download more source sheets, rabbimanning.com. You can look on there. I have around 100 shirim on the website on different topics related to this. So you can go there and you can find those, and they'll take you to different places. I don't have any more, actually. I'm sorry. If you don't mind just sharing, I have what I have. And, it's funny. It's always nice to say on the recording that we've run out of source sheets. And I once gave a shir in which there was one person in the shir. We recorded the shir, and somebody sent me a message about like a week later. I listened to your shir online, and I think it's really inappropriate that you only took questions from the same person all the way through. So now when I have like one or two people in the shir, I'm saying like, yes, the lady right at the very back. Yes, you speak up. We can't hear you, madam. So let's get into it. There's always some resistance to rabbinic law. People, it's kind of built into Jewish genes that okay, I'll accept what God says, but what rabbis say, I don't trust rabbis. It's interesting. Christian atheists have a problem with God. Jewish atheists don't have problems with God usually. They have problems with rabbis. Like, why should I listen to you? And I didn't bring it on the sheet, but the Gemara about Hillel and different Gerim that came to Hillel to ask to be converted. So there's a story there in the Gemara in Shabbos, I think it's Lamed Aleph, of a Ger comes and says, to Shammai, how many Torahs do you have? And we said, we have two. We have the written Torah, we have the oral Torah. Oh, I don't want the oral Torah. So Shammai throws him out. And Hillel, of course, accepts him and says, okay, we'll work on that. And the first day that Hillel teaches him, he teaches him the Aleph Bet. He's a non-Jew, he has no background. Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet. Great, that's the end of lesson one. So the next day, the Ger comes back for lesson two, and he points to Aleph, and he says, this is Dalet, points to Bet, this is Gimel. And he goes, whoa, 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 yesterday you taught me everything completely the other way around. So Hillel smiles at him and said, ah, so you do need rabbis after all. Meaning, without some kind of oral law, without some kind of interpretation and explanation, you don't know where to start, you don't know what's Aleph base, you don't know which vowels are under the psukim, and even groups that claim not to have any oral law, Karaites, Samaritans, they all have oral law. They just have their oral law. They have their interpretive process. I once went to visit the Samaritans in the Shomron. Very interesting experience. And I was in a house there. We were talking in a meeting as a group of us. And they claim we only have the Torah Shebichtav. We don't have any written, any oral law. So I said to him, well, do you keep kosher? He goes, of course, what do you think we are? The Reformed Samaritans, we keep real kosher here. So I said to him, would you have separate meat and milk in your kitchen? He said, of course. I said, why would anyone without an oral law have separate meat and milk in their kitchen? It's completely, drawn from interpretation. He said, ooh, that's a good question. I'll have to ask the Kohen Gadol. They have a Kohen Gadol. So I'm just saying, they have an oral law. And if you ever visit the Samaritans, my suggestion is just go to the Kohen Gadol because you'll get the best answers, hopefully, there. So I'm going to go through a few issues which I think are really just headlines, but I think you'll enjoy them. Let's start with source number one. There's a Gemara in Shabbos here in Chaf Gimel which asks the question about the bracha we make on rabbinic mitzvahs. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Ashi, Amar Rav, Hamadlik Neshel Chanukah Tzarech Levarech. You light Chanukah candles, you need to make a bracha. May Mevarech, what bracha do you make on Chanukah candles? Says the Gemara, Mevarech Hashem Kedushanu Mitzvah Savit Sivanu Lahadlik Neshel Chanukah. Okay, good. Says the Gemara, Heichin Sivanu, how can you say Vitsivanu? God, you have commanded us, God, to light the to light Chanukah candles. God didn't command us to light Chanukah candles. The rabbis is purely rabbinic. It's a rabbinic festival. So how can I say Vitsivanu? So the Gemara answers two answers. Rav Avia Amar, so Rav Avia says, Milotosor, which we'll get to in a minute, the mitzvah of Lotosor, not to deviate from what the rabbis told us. So that's what we mean when we say Vitsivanu. God told us to listen to the rabbis, and the rabbis told us to light Chanukah candles. And Rav Nechemia Amar, Sha'al Avicha V'yageitcha Zekeinecha V'yomru Lach. Meaning we're part of a chain of Masorah. Rav Kook actually has an analysis of this Gemara where he says these are two elements of rabbinic law. One is authority-based. There's an authority of the rabbis that I have to listen to, and we'll define, see which rabbis we're talking about. And the other one is Masorah-based. That I'm not just listening to authority, I'm part of a chain of tradition going back and back and back and back and back, and this is not something we just made up now. Sha'al avicha v'yagecha zekeinecha, your parents, your grandparents, etc. But they're all rooted in this rabbinic authority. That's why we say Vitzivanu. In fact, there is a view, and I brought it to you in the Yerushalmi, that on every single rabbinic mitzvah that we make a bracha on, we always make the same bracha. Look at number two. Yerushalmi says, "Kol moedim b'yontif rishon shehu oimah alitilas lulav." So yontif rishon, you say the bracha alitilat lulav. Shake the shalom mitzvah savitzivanu alitilat lulav. The first day of Sukkot is a Torah mitzvah to shake the lulav, to lift up the lulav. Or so fine. So that's the first day. But what about the rest of the day? My pagin, my pligin. What do they disagree on? B'shar kol yamim, on the rest of Sukkot. For the after the first day, the mitzvah to shake the lulav is a rabbinic mitzvah. So what bracha are you going to make? So Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan says, oh, let's say bracha alatilas lulav. Ah, vitzivanu. Okay, we know we commanded through the rabbinic process. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Amar al mitzvat zekeinim. Can you imagine if every single time we did a rabbinic mitzvah, every time we lit Shabbos candles, every time we did Chanukah candles, every time we did second day Yontzer stuff, every time, instead of saying Asheki Deshanu Mitzvah Sivanu on Vitzivanu on that bracha, on that mitzvah, we said Asheki Deshanu Mitzvah Sivanu Vitzivanu Al Mitzvah Zekeinim. So it would impress on us the fact that we're doing this mitzvah, not because God said in the Torah to do this mitzvah, but because God said in the Torah, we'll see where, to listen to the rabbis, and the rabbis said to do this mitzvah. It's actually a very interesting perspective. Of course, we don't paskin that way, but I brought you the Rishalmi so you would see that idea that was even touted there by Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Now, the Rambam is a very important resource on this. The Rambam, Maimonides, talks a lot about rabbinic process in his introduction to the Mishnah, which is his general introduction to the oral law, which is massive. It's a whole book in and of itself. And also in his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, we'll see from both places. But I just want to bring you very briefly from the introduction to the Mishnah itself, says the Rambam in number 3. Nimsa lefi haklalim sheikdamnu, shekol adinim hakfuim b'Torah nechalakim lechamisha chalakim. You can divide every single halakha, which is part of the oral law, not part of the Torah itself, into one of five categories. And he says, I challenge you, he says, put it in one of these five categories. Of course, again, we could have a shir on every one, but we'll just overview them for now. Hachelik harishon hapeirushim ha-mekubalim imoshe, says the Rambam, there are explanations that we got at Sinai of what the Torah means. When it says, eat matzah, what's a matzah? Meaning there's no point Moshe Rabbeinu coming down and saying, oh, today's new mitzvah is, eat matzah. What's matzah? I don't know. Okay, that's useless. Sit in a sukkah. What's a sukkah? I don't know. So, says the Rambam, there was always a user guide, a manual, if you like, that goes with the written law, that explains what each word means, how you read them, what they're referring to. Everyone knows, I used to be a lawyer, I'm sure there are many of you who are in that kind of field. If you don't define your terms, then nobody knows what's going on with the contract. You have to have defined terms. So he says, that's the Perushim HaMukubalim in Moshe. That's number one. Hachelik HaSheini, Heim Adinim Shebehem HaMoshe, Heim Halacha LaMoshe Misina. The second category are what we call Halacha LaMoshe Misina, which the Rambam differs from the first category in that these are not things linked to the text. These are just laws that you would never have known, not indicated or hinted to in the text. They're laws given as part of an oral law to Moshe. But it's a small category. often when people are taught rabbinic law, they're given the impression God gave everything to Moshe, and Moshe just handed it down. The whole of the halakhic system we have is handed down from Moshe Rabbeinu. I bet most people are probably told that in some way or other at high school. The Rambam has a major problem with that. And that major problem is, you know, summarized in one word, which is machlokas. Why is there so much machlokas? Well, see, maybe there's less than we think, but there's a lot of debate and dispute. If everything was given to Moshe on Sinai, in one way or another, and handed down faithfully, the only reasonable explanation for so much debate and discussion is that everyone's just lost the Masorah. Everyone's confused. Because if they weren't confused, they wouldn't be arguing about what does this mean and what does that mean. The Rambam says it's absolutely wrong to say that the Torah was given down to Moshe in its entirety, because then you're basically saying that we're all playing broken telephone. You're all going, what does this mean? We don't know. We heard this. We thought. He says it's completely wrong. He's very negative about that. It's a misunderstanding. He said, yes, there are two categories, these first two, where God hands it to Moshe, but they're relatively contained. They're relatively limited. The others, 3, 4, and 5, are all innovated in some way by the rabbis, and that's why there's machlokas. Look at the, just further down again, I've just given you the headlines. The Rambam says there's an interpretive process. There are rules we call midot, there are systems, interpretive systems whereby the rabbis darshan. And of course, we read this in the morning, the Rabbi Yishmael's favorite 13, you know, the Yud Gimel Midot, Shea Torah Nidreshet Bahem. Everyone always wants to find 13, 13 this, 13 that. We're very obsessed with 13. It's a prime number. We love prime numbers. It's interesting. Non-Jews tend to be a bit scared of prime numbers sometimes. But we're very into prime numbers. I've got some theories on why that might be. But anyway, those 13 are just Rabbi Yishmael's favorites. There are really many, many more. The Malbim lists 613, another prime number, different rules that the rabbis gave to interpret the Torah. Again, he gets to that number because he wants to get to that number. The point is there's a lot of interpretation, and that is subject to machlokas, because you'd expect machlokas. The rabbis are looking at the verses in the Torah, and they're saying, using certain interpretive methodologies to say, what does this mean? If everybody agreed, you'd think it was a cover-up. Yeah, because how can a bunch of different people look at the same data and all come to exactly the same conclusions? If they were highly professionally trained, you'd expect them to have different opinions. Doctors look at the same data and have basically the same medical training in the Western world, and you have different diagnoses, different prognosis, and different advice. Why? Do they not know what they're talking about? No, because very highly qualified people look at things in different ways, even with the same data. Says the Rambam, that's why there's machlokas. There's no machlokas in number one and number two. None. He challenges you. You find me any machlokas in Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim. Of course, every rabbi in the last 800 years since the Rambam has been trying to find, you know, oh, well, what about this, and what about that, and what about this? That's a whole book in and of itself. But he said there's interpretation, and this interpretation is central, the biggest of all parts of the rabbinic system. Just in a line, I have a moshel that I like to give, that drash is just a lens through which you see the psukim. Most of us are wearing like pshat glasses most of the time, and we look at psukim and you see for example, kabedes avicha ve'eti me'echa, honor your father and mother. How do you translate the word et? So everybody knows from, you know, age 5 and onwards, you don't translate the word et. It's a grammatical construct and it does this, that, and the other. You don't translate it. Good, so it's honor your father and your mother. That's wearing your pshat glasses. But if you take off your pshat glasses, it's a bit like 3D glasses. You know, you go to a cinema. Do they even have 3D cinemas anymore? The little red and blue things that you used to put on your eyes, remember that? I bet they don't have them anymore. But I've got a pair at home somewhere. Whatever. You go to a 3D movie and you don't put your special 3D glasses on. And you say, I don't know why I'm here. It's all blurred. I mean, I paid like 25 quid to see this special movie and it's all blurred. They say, well, put the glasses on. You know, whoa, like everything's flying out. Drash is just another pair of lenses that you wear, and you just see the psukim in a different way. Through these interpretive systems, for example, X doesn't mean nothing in drash. It means you're coming to include something else. So honor your father and mother, honored with drash lenses, comes to include your stepfather, comes to include your stepmother, comes maybe to include siblings. You're just looking at things in a different way. If I drew a 111 on the board here and said, what's that number? You say it's 111.
I said, well, why? You're assuming that we're working in decimal in base 10. Well, maybe it's binary. Maybe it's in base 6. Maybe it's not that number. You're making assumptions. The way you view things, that's the lens through which you view them. And the rabbis have this drash lens through which they view the psukim, and they innovate new ideas. And then chelik ha-revi'i, the chelik ha-chamishi, is basically what we call rabbinic law. Look at chelik ha-revi'i. Hey, madinim shekav'im ha-nevi'im v'ha-chachamim. These are the laws, shekav'um ha-nevi'im ha-chachamim, that were fixed by the nevi'im, the prophets and the rabbis. Shebechol dor bador, in every generation, we'll see there's a limit to that. Al derech ha-gedi v'ha-siag, there are gezeira, there are fence around the Torah to protect the Torah, more about that in a minute. V'ha-chelik ha-chamishi, and there's a fifth category, heim din shenasu b'derech ha-ion, they looked into life, the rabbis, and they wanted to fix up society, introduce new regulations, rabbinic laws that they're not protective laws. They don't protect the Torah in case you come to breach a Torah law, but they enhance your religious life. They are takanot, institutions, and what he calls minhagot. Now, it's interesting, we're not used to hearing the word minhagot. Don't confuse minhagot with minhagim. Minhagim are not what we're talking about here. Minhagim are customs, and they don't come from the top down. They come from the bottom up. People start minhagim. I don't think a rabbi ever clapped on a shtender and said, from now on, none of us are going to eat kidney on. People had bad experiences with rice, with this, with that, and they grew minhagim that they don't eat kidney on. But minhagim are not part of this process. Often when people point the finger at the halakhic system and say, why does everyone do different things? That doesn't fill me with confidence. They're doing this and the Sfarim are doing this and the Ashkenazim. Many of those things that they're pointing to are actually minhag oriented. And when it comes to minhag, there's nothing to do with the halakhic system. They can become halakhically binding, yes. That's not today's share. But minhagim are created from the ground up, not from the top down. It's a different system. Here, minhagot means certain kinds of rabbinic law which have a rubric of minhag. For example, dati hudit in the laws of tzniut is a rabbinic construct with a rubric of minhag. It's minhag oriented the way you look at it. Second day yontif has a rubric of minhag. Even though it's a rabbinic law, the way you judge who does and who doesn't have to keep second day yontif is based on the rules of minhag. It's just another form of rabbinic law. But again, don't confuse the minhagot from the top down and the minhagim from the bottom up. So the Rambam basically challenges us. Every time you see any halakha, which is not explicitly in the Torah, and which is not, let's say, a minhag of people, it fits into one of these five categories. It would be nice if the Gemara came with five color codes. You go through the Gemara, you know, this is blue and this is red and this is yellow and this is orange and then you would see more clearly, oh, this is in here and this is in here. And therefore, that's a whole life's work to try and work out how this happens. Okay, good. The Rambam has talked a lot about rabbis. Which rabbis are rabbis? When he says, the rabbis did this, the rabbis did that. So have a look at number four. This is actually very foundational. The Sanhedrin that was set up in Parshas Baalotcha, number four, Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Esfar li shivim ish, gather me 70 men, mizikne Yisrael, asher yadata ki hem zikne ha'am. These are the elders of the people, the Shor tribe, and those who were, the policemen, if you like, in Egypt. There's a whole parashanut there as to how they picked these 70 men. And I'm not getting into whether the Sanhedrin can have women. I'm not getting into that now. That's a whole shira in and of itself. Will our future Sanhedrin have women or just men? Not now, okay? The lakachta otam el ho'el moed, take them to the tent of meeting, v'idyatz v'sham imach, and they'll stand there with you. V'yaradati v'dibarti imcha, I'm going to come and speak to you, Moshe, Sham. V'atzalti min haruach hasher alecha, v'samti aleihem. Atzalti is actually later became a very Kabbalistically overlaid word of atzilut. I'll overflow. I will let this sort of spirit that's on you, Moshe, overflow onto them. And they will carry the burden of the people with you. And you won't have to do it alone. Meaning Moshe complains, I can't deal with these people alone. And God says to him, you don't need to. You have this backup crowd. You have this Sanhedrin which will be there to work with you. And that is the origin of the 70, the body Sanhedrin, the 70 men that sit with Moshe, and then 71, and then all through the generations. And we had a Sanhedrin all through the generations, through the first temple, through the second temple. There's less direct reference to it in the Tanakh for the first temple, but there's some.
And in the Second Temple, it's very, very widely discussed. We had a body called the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were, says the Rambam, the group of people who had the authority and the mandate and the requirement to actually create rabbinic law. What happened to the Sanhedrin? Eventually, the people stopped basically following the Sanhedrin. The breakdown in the Second Temple period, the Sinat Chinam was also accompanied by a breakdown in authority generally. Jewish society fell apart. The Romans destroyed everything. Eventually, the Byzantines came and abolished the Sanhedrin and actually killed the last Nasi of the Sanhedrin, and that was the end of the Sanhedrin. So we have not had a Sanhedrin for about, 1,300 years? 1,600 years. Something like 1,600 years, we haven't had a Sanhedrin. But, and here's the key thing, the rabbinic law that we have today was basically created by that Sanhedrin, and not very much afterwards. We'll talk about a little bit more about that afterwards. But now the rabbis who we have in today's world do not anymore have the authority of the Sanhedrin. We could get back a Sanhedrin. That's a shiur that I gave in Finchley on Thursday night, and there have been bona fide attempts to restore a Sanhedrin over the last 800 years. Including a very famous one by Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Yaakov Beirav, which in the 16th century in Sfat. I'm going to talk a bit more about that this afternoon and there. So we could restore the Sanhedrin. And maybe we should restore the Sanhedrin. Why do we not have a Sanhedrin? Because we can't get our act together. The Rambam says if the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael could just agree on one candidate, one consensus candidate, that would be the seed of a new Sanhedrin, then he could then give smicha to the original smicha, the ordination that the Sanhedrin needs to other candidates, and you'd have a Sanhedrin. Once we had a Sanhedrin, then there's lots we could do, because the powers that the Sanhedrin have to interpret, to produce rabbinic law, etc., are very, very considerable. And we don't have those powers today, and therefore, if you want to cry about something on Tisha B'Av, and you don't feel that the temple and the sacrifices really touches you in a big way, then cry about the fact that we can't get our act together to get a new Sanhedrin, and then we could open up a lot of these questions that we sometimes people want to open up. And also, by the way, you can't have Mashiach without a Sanhedrin, because the Sanhedrin are the ones that give the stempel of approval that this person really is the Mashiach. So we need to work out a way to get a Sanhedrin if we ever want to get to Mashiach. Of course, there might be someone, crawling in the forests of Mongolia who's been getting unbroken smicha for the last 1,600 years, but don't rely on that. You know, it's probably not happening. The only way to do it is the consensus candidate in the Rambam. Eliyahu HaNavi might be the answer, by the way. If Eliyahu HaNavi somehow appears and he's got... Okay, that's another topic. Okay, fine. What is the source of this rabbinic authority? Over to page 2. So, looking at source number 5, very, very important. In Parshas Shoftim, so the Torah tells us, what is the authority of the rabbis? Ki palem imcha davar. If you don't know what to do, which, by the way, implies at the beginning that why do you even need these rabbis? You should know the answer. But if you don't know the answer, if you're not competent, which maybe we all should be, but if you don't know the answer, you can go to a group of people. Devar mishpat, bein dam ledam, bein din ledin, bein nega lenega, different kinds of halachic questions. Divrei rivois b'sharecha. And there's a disagreement in your local bed din. You'll get up, you'll go to the place that God chooses. That became, of course, the temple in Yerushalayim. Go to the Sanhedrin of your day, to the judges of your day. You can't turn around and say, oh, our guys are not as good as they used to be. Yeah, no, that's nostalgia will not help you. We're not dealing with the past, we're dealing with who you have now. The darashta, and seek the answer from them. And they will tell you at Dvar HaMishpat what the law is. You must do what they tell you from that place. Hashem, which God chose. And here's the key line. Al pi haTorah asher yorucha, according to the Torah which they teach. And the laws that they give you. Ta'aseh. That's one Torah mitzvah. Do that. Lot asur, and do not deviate min adavar sheyigidu lecha yamin u'smal. Do not deviate to the right or the left from what they say. They are binding. Even if you say, well, they're not my rabbi, they are. The Sanhedrin are your rabbi, my rabbi, they're every Jew's rabbi. They have the authority of the Torah. And that's very important, because sometimes people ask, what authorities do the rabbi have? What authority does the rabbis have? And the answer is they can't give themselves authority. That's the circular. You have to listen to me because I say you have to listen to me. That doesn't work. You have to listen to the Sanhedrin, as I do, because
The Torah tells us, it tells us in two mitzvahs, that you have to listen to the Sanhedrin. And that's why the Rambam says that somewhat counterintuitively, if you break a rabbinic mitzvah on purpose, unconsciously, knowing that it's a rabbinic mitzvah and you don't care, you're actually, says the Rambam, breaking two Torah mitzvahs. So if I pick up a piece of pork and say, you know something, to heck with it, I'm eating pork, I broke a Torah mitzvah. If I pick up a piece of chicken cooked in milk, which is rabbinic law and on a Torah level is completely permitted, and parav, well, the chicken's parav, the milk's not parav, okay? So then I broke two Torah mitzvahs because I didn't follow what the rabbi said and I deviated from what they said, okay? So the Ramban has a field day and says, like, really, you're telling me that a Torah law is less stringent in some ways than rabbinic law? Then why are we more strict? Why are we stricter with a Torah law than we are with the rabbinic law? To which the Rambam's answer is, because the rabbis can decide what the rubric is with their mitzvah, and they told us to be less strict with it, even though they really have no less authority than the Torah law, because they're based on two Torah laws. Why would the rabbis tell you to be less stringent with rabbinic law when really they're just the same? So that you don't confuse Torah laws with rabbinic laws, and you know this is min haTorah, and this is midrabbanon, because there is a mitzvah in the Torah not to add on to the Torah. So you can't think this is mitzvah 614, 615, 616. You say, no, I know this is a rabbinic mitzvah. Ah, is it any less binding? No, it's probably more binding. But it's a different kind of mitzvah, and therefore fits into a different category. And therefore, there's a lot to say about source number five. The Rambam said, who does this apply to? The Sanhedrin and the replacement of the Sanhedrin. What is the replacement of the Sanhedrin? The Talmud, the Gemara. The Gemara was written once and once only to replace the Sanhedrin. That's why the Gemara looks and sounds like it looks. The Sanhedrin was a group of rabbis all talking to each other and also interacting with past Sanhedrins, overruling them and debating with them. And the Gemara has to replicate thousands of rabbis talking to each other, across each other, back, previous generations, future generations, because that's what the Sanhedrin did. That's why the Gemara looks like it looks. It's a completely unique production. No other human culture has produced anything like the Gemara, and we never produced one since. Why did we never write a second Gemara? Why did Rashi never come along in the 11th century and say, you know something, this Gemara is like 700 years old, 600 years old. Let's make a new one. You know, every generation makes a new Shulchan Aruch, basically. We'll see that this afternoon. But because the Gemara, you never needed more than one. You never needed one before, because the Sanhedrin was there. And you never needed one afterwards, because this replaces the Sanhedrin. So says the Rambam, the Gemara also has the authority of the Sanhedrin. But no one after. And the Rambam is very clear. Any rabbi that comes after the Gemara is a product of the post-Talmudic world where the Jews were scattered all around the world. There was no consensus and they're local rabbis. Therefore, no rabbi can come, says the Rambam, after the Talmud and say, you have to listen to me. Because you can say, it's very nice, I respect your authority in your community, but you're not my rabbi. I don't have to listen to you. And if you don't like that community, go move, go somewhere else. No rabbinic opinion combined us, says the Rambam, after the Talmud, because the Talmud and the Sanhedrin have this power. You should just know that the Sefer HaChinuch has a different view, and the Sefer HaChinuch says, yet also the senior poskim in every generation have the ability, have the authority of Lotasur to bind us. And there's a debate about that, and that gets us into the very murky waters of what today is called Das Torah. You know, does my local Godel, maybe not local, but does the Godel Hador, whatever the Godel Hador means in today's world, which is not at all clear, do they have the authority to tell me I have to do X, and it binds me, even if I haven't picked them as my rabbi, because of Das Torah, because it has the power of Lo Sosor, and there's a whole, not just a shir, but a series of shirim on that. And what kind of issues does it regulate? Is it just pure halakhic issues? If I believe in Das Torah, which clearly the Rambam doesn't, can they tell me how to vote? I remember many, many years ago, when I was living in Yerushalayim, the Yated Ne'eman used to arrive on our doorstep. It wasn't our paper, it was the next door neighbor's paper, you should just know. And I remember the day before an election, don't remember which election it was, there have been a lot, there was a picture of Rav Eliashiv, so that already dates it to like, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 years ago, a picture of his face on the front, and just two words in the biggest font you could possibly imagine in a newspaper, and just said, Lo Tasur. Lo Tasur, which basically is, Rav Eliashiv has told you how to vote. If you don't do what you're told, you are in breach of a Torah mitzvah of not listening to the rabbis. And even though the Rambam wouldn't have any time for that, the Sefer HaChinuch might say, okay, you know something? If he's the gadol in your community, maybe you have to do what he says, and there's a debate about that, but that's not for now. But you should just know, at least for the Gemara, this is there. The Rashi makes an important point, which is really not debated, which is that the Gemara doesn't really add much to the principles of rabbinic law. You'll think, well, that's a bit weird, because the Mishnah is such a small book, and the Gemara is hundreds of times the size of the Mishnah, but actually the role of the Gemara is really analyzing and interpreting and explaining the Mishnah, and it doesn't really add many fundamental rabbinic principles, and we could talk more about that another time. Fine, let's go on a little bit. Let's do a couple of things quickly. There is a pasuk in the Torah, number 7, Ushmatim et mishmarati, you must protect my protection, which, says the Rambam, is a mitzvah on the rabbis, based on the Gemara, a mitzvah on the rabbis to make rabbinic law. If you look in number 9 for a second, Gamit bar mehem dvarim shegazru chachamim v'nevim, there are many things that the rabbis and the prophets made by way of rabbinic law, shebechol dor vador, in every generation, lasot siag v'torah, k'mo sheshamu mimoshe b'feirush. And this authority and this mandate was given to them explicitly by Moshe, Shneemar Ushmartem et Mishmarti. You must create guards for my Torah. Asu Mishmeret leMishmarti, says God. I've given you mitzvot. You have an obligation to protect them. The Maharal in number 10, which you can read in your own time, says like anything precious is protected. He talks about our fingers and our toes that have nails on them in order to, you know, keep them safe, and our brain, which has like a skull around it. So the mitzvahs are very precious. Why would you not have a system to protect them? You know, your kid goes to see the Grand Canyon, you're standing there, and he's going right the edge, and look down here, it's really fun. So, you know, you can see just fine from back here. You can make a fence in order to stop someone from falling into a hole, as it were. And therefore, the Maharal says, that's why the rabbis were given this imperative, not just permission, but imperative, in order to create rabbinic law. And the authority that binds us is the one that I mentioned in Parsha Shoftim. Go over to page number 3. A very fascinating comment by the Maratz Chayis, which is not so well known. Number 11, he says as follows. Harbe gzeirot nimtza etzleinu b'mishnah stam. Many rabbinic principles of law are given to us in the Mishnah stam. Meaning, stam here means no debate, no disagreement, no discussion. It's just understood that this is part of the structure and fabric of rabbinic law. No, lo nechlak behem adam meolam, and no one ever even suggested there was any question about them. We can't know exactly when they were made. Because the Gemara, the Mishnah already, which is our first recording of the oral law in the second century, it just takes them as axiomatic. And therefore he explains, ubli safek, there's no question, kulam ba'u eleinu min ha-bedin ha-gadol. When the Mishnah takes something as being agreed on and unanimously accepted, it came from the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was still functioning, more or less, when the Mishnah was written. Asher nigzeru mehem b'ma'amad shalem, and it was made there with a quorum, a full quorum, okay? Acher she'amdu aleihem l'minyan, after they took that debate and vote in the Sanhedrin. So we often think of the halachic system as just like all the rabbis disagreeing with each other about everything. That's just a, what's the word? A canard. That's just a narrative that people have. It's just not true. There are so many aspects of rabbinic law, forget about Torah law, which are just unanimously agreed on. I brought you some examples. Just in the laws of Shabbat, the rabbinic laws of Shabbat, which is one tiny sliver of the whole corpus of rabbinic law, I brought you, all these things are accepted without any debate. Not to leave uncooked food on the fire before Shabbat, not to ask a non-Jew to work on Shabbat, not to have a wedding on Shabbat, not to swim on Shabbat, to make Kiddush and Havdalah on Shabbat, on wine, not to have a court case, not to make a loan, to light Shabbos candles, muksa. No one suggests that, oh, there's no such thing as Shabbos candles, or there's no such thing as asking a non. These are agreed. These are agreed on principles, and therefore, actually, if I take a piece of paper and just put a little dot on it and say, what's this? You'll all say, it's dot, because you automatically go to the one thing which is the exception. Actually, it's a piece of paper which is 99% clear, and there's no dot there on most of the rest of the paper, and therefore there's a lot, even though we have this kind of narrative that the rabbis are always arguing, there's so much which is agreed on, and says the Maratz Chayis, that is coming from the Sanhedrin itself. Fine. A couple of words on why the Torah didn't include rabbinic law, and then I'll give you some examples, and we'll draw it to a close. Why would there be such a thing as rabbinic law? Why can't the Torah just include all this? You know, if it wants, if they're mandated in a way by the Torah, they have the authority of the Torah through Lo Sasor, so why did the Torah not just include it? Why leave it to people? So that's a very important point, which we need to dwell on for a few minutes. So look at number 12. There's a very important pasuk, Lo Shamayni. The Torah is not in heaven. When Moshe, you know, wraps up and signs off on the Torah, he says, from now on, you're not getting it from God. Leimor mi yale lanu shamayma. Who's going to go to the heavens? Vikache, and bring the Torah, vikache lanu, etc. The Torah is not in heaven. So if you look in the Ramchal says a beautiful idea. Number 13. Kol hatakanot ha'elu. All these rabbinic laws. Hinei. Da'ato yitbarach shemo mesakemet sheyishamru shmira me'ula. God wants you to keep all these rabbinic laws very carefully, k'chol mitzvot haTorah atzma, like all the mitzvot in the Torah. Ukvar haya ra'ui she'itzaveh aleihem hu yitbarach shemo, and God could have easily given those rabbinic laws in the Torah, b'Torah atzma, ele shehaya ratzon lefanav sheyavo hadavar mitzideinu. Halacha has to be a partnership. There has to be a partnership. The ein hevdel ben mitzvot ben haTorah mitzvot derabanan. There is no really between Torah and rabbinic mitzvahs, only to the extent that the rabbis themselves made a distinction. Dehainu hasvekas b'dinei Torah. Okay, yadenu l'chumra. So when it comes to Torah, we go machmir. V'divrei sefer yadenu l'chumra. Amnam be'inyan chiyuv hamitzvah. When it comes to the nature and the obligatory nature of the mitzvah, ein hefresh bein eila le'eila klal. There is no difference between Torah and rabbinic mitzvahs in principle. Except that God wants us to be the source of Torah. Torah is a joint exercise. Torah is a partnership. And it can't just come from heteronomous source, which is coming from outside us. It has to come from an autonomous source as well. And the Meshech Chochma says very clearly, number 14, HaTorah ratzah Hashem milvad inyanim hanitzchim umekayimim la'ad. The Torah really wanted that in addition to things which never change, okay, there should be things which do. Yitchadesh inyanim. There should be other things which do change. Siagim, azharot, chumrot, asher ye zmaniim. Which are zmani. Meaning the purpose of rabbinic law is meant to keep halacha relevant. Because you can't have a system from 3,300 years ago, which is fixed entirely, which speaks to every generation. You just can't do that. It will become fossilized. It will become irrelevant. You have to have a system whereby there's a group of human beings responsible for interpreting. Okay, there are red lines. You can't just do anything you like. But there's a lot of room for interpretation, and therefore that's why there has to be a rabbinic system, to keep it fresh, to keep it interesting, to keep it relevant. Now, what do we have today? Again, no Sanhedrin. It's a disaster. We have no Sanhedrin. We daven every day. Hashiva shavteinu kevarishona. Every day we daven, please get us back a Sanhedrin. Why? Because we need a system which is responsive and flexible within boundaries, but responsive. We have a Gemara, which is fantastic, and it's got amazing things in it. And you can delve deep, and you can find surrogate motherhood sources, and this one, and you can, amazing, brilliant. But at the end of the day, it's not as good as the real thing. We really need a Sanhedrin, and therefore the Sanhedrin's purpose is to bring in this flexibility, etc. So just look with me in the last couple of minutes. I brought you some examples. You can read this on your own on the bottom of page 3 and page 4. Don't make the mistake of thinking that all rabbinic law is fences. You know, this is something that people tend to moan about. Oh, the rabbis are always making fences and fences round fences and fences round fences round fences. No, that's not how it works. There are some fences, you know, don't pick up a pen on Shabbat in case you come to write with it, muksa. But most rabbinic law is actually positive and innovative. Make brachot, because it'll enhance your religious life. And I brought you all sorts of examples of takanot, which are not fences at all, which are coming from the Sanhedrin, from the rabbinic system. Again, almost all of them completely agreed upon and unanimous, that will enhance our life in different ways. And these are just a small, a list of things that could easily have been expanded into hundreds and hundreds more. Fine. Just in the last 2 or 3 minutes, I just want to give you 4 or 5 headlines that you can go away and think about and research on your own. What are the limits on the Sanhedrin? It didn't have unlimited powers. So I brought here five. Number one, they could not override the Torah itself. The Sanhedrin can't tell you that pigs are kosher. That doesn't fall within their remit. Although they do have some power by way of what's called a Hora'at Shah to temporarily override certain things. And maybe even permanent in certain ways if it's more passive. You all know that we don't blow the shofar on Shabbos. Because the rabbis say, don't blow the shofar, even though that's a Torah mitzvah, because you might come to carry on Shabbat. So there are limited exceptions, but the rabbis cannot normally override the Torah. The Sanhedrin can usually override a previous Sanhedrin. That keeps it fresh. The new generation says, we're going to look again at the halacha, and we're going to say, actually, now we need to do it like this. The Sanhedrin normally cannot override the will of the people. It's not exactly a democracy, but the Sanhedrin, look in Hilchas Mamrim of the Rambam, he goes through, the Sanhedrin has to do a lot of market research before they bring in any new law, and to check that people can deal with it, the people want it, the people can cope with it, because if the people don't want it and can't cope with it, they don't have the authority to make it. They're not autocratic. And by the way, if they do make something where the people basically say, no, we can't do that, then it doesn't have authority. There are examples of that throughout history. They do not normally make a gezerah to protect another gezerah. And I put here, they don't normally act in weird and unusual cases. And the one thing that we need to think about is, so what can we change halakhically without a Sanhedrin? What could a Sanhedrin do, etc.? So I've really just brought you just a few outlines. This is a topic which I find absolutely fascinating. I think a lot of people need to have opportunities to see this in more detail. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them in the last 2 or 3 minutes. But again, if you go to my website, and my website refers you to lots of other places as well, you'll get a lot more on that. So hopefully that was interesting, helpful in 40 minutes. But yes. Right. Well, there actually are certain campaigns. There's even a group of people who call themselves the Sanhedrin. They have a website, sanhedrin.org or something like that. I think there's a concern that when you start getting into Sanhedrin focus, people become messianic and go off the rails. Okay. Actually, I think that you should separate the two. There's no reason why we can't have a Sanhedrin and Mashiach come 150 years later. Same as Geula, by the way. Geula is also not a messianic idea. We can have Geula now and Mashiach later. Okay, so I think there's a lot of nervousness because we've gone off the rails a few times with messianic things. But there were real, genuine attempts to try and restart Sanhedrins because we really see this. Maybe we should deflect some of the messianic stuff into the Sanhedrin stuff. And the way we'll get a Sanhedrin is by building bridges between people and communities, because that's what you need in order to get one. So maybe that's the way we should deal with it. Yes?
So one metaphor that I've heard, I quite like and want to hear your opinion on, is that rabbis post the closing of the Gemara, post Sanhedrin, basically all rabbis of whatever stature, they're all essentially lawyers. And they present arguments, and their goal is to help later make better informed decisions.
Right.
But they're not...
Lawyers / judges, in the sense that if you decide to go to that rabbi, which you didn't have to, you pick that rabbi, then you're bound by his...
Specifically bound?
Yes.
There's no
appeals procedure. If you don't like the psak that you got from your rabbi, you can't appeal that I want a different psak. You can say to another rabbi, I think the first rabbi just missed the point. He didn't understand the question. He just made a mistake. That happens. And then you can go. But there's no appeal in that sense. So yes, metaphysically bound. But yes, also lawyers in the sense that they're interpreting rather than creating. 100%. I don't mind the metaphor. Maybe lawyers can be judges as well. Yes, sir.
When you say
yes. Yes. That's it. What the Muslims said about Islam, it was confused about us, that we were confused. Good. And the Christians also said that, how can you trust the system when all these rabbis are screaming at each other and they don't agree with each other? The Rambam, I think, was definitely addressing that fact. And he has good legs to stand on. He says, for example, pre-Eitz Hadar is an etrog, and you won't find any debate as to whether it's a banana or a star fruit or a kumquat. It's always an esra. So he says, look, you know, all the debate is on the... Also, we debate and discuss things that most religions don't really care about.
You tell a Christian to light a candle, they light a candle, they're happy, they did it, they did a mitzvah, they're happy. You tell Jews to light candles, you have a whole chapter of Mishnayos. This kind of candle, this kind of oil, this kind of wick, this kind of this. So we do debate things which most people don't care so much about. But I agree that the Rambam is coming in a context. He's actually fighting more against the Karaites than the Muslims. When the Rambam came to his community, two-thirds of his community were Karaites. Okay, we have to leave it there because there are other things happening. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. To be continued, Be'ezrat Hashem.